Black and white and red all over. Ian Murtagh. He can talk football all day.
Well, this is the first time that the Black and White and Red All Over show has been on the same day as two of our sides have already played. And I must admit, I didn't expect to be commenting on two very, very good away results for Middlesbrough and Sunderland. Sunderland ended a horrible run of just 1 point from seven games with a apparently comfortable win at Cardiff. Middlesbrough, well, that's five unbeaten, and although they didn't win at Southampton, I'm sure most Middlesbrough fans would have taken a point. Yes, they're still 9 points off the playoffs, and odds are very much against them making it, but unlike one or two sides up there, Dave, Michael Carrick's out of a bit of momentum, don't they?
Yeah. What is it? Five unbeaten now. Three wins, two draws. Borough fans will be kicking themselves, thinking there should have been some more points in that run, but it's not a bad run when you've been such an inconsistent team.
That's right. And I mean, listen, you go into Easter, all you want is it's something to look forward to, don't you? You know, you want your season to be still alive. And, well, Middlesbrough's season, it is still alive. OK, we haven't got the possibilities that we had back in the new year when they were still involved in two cup competitions and looking relatively good for the playoffs. But, you know, there'll be a decent crowd against Sheffield Wednesday. There'll be a good away following, of course, at the Riverside on Monday afternoon.
Normally is with Wednesday,
Absolutely. And if Middlesbrough win, well, you know, six games unbeaten, they'll be the form side outside Leeds in the Championship. Sunderland, well, you know, a wonderful wonder result. It was horrible form, wasn't it? And I'm sure one or two fans, they weren't looking at up the table, they were looking over the shoulders, because if you've lost six and then drawn 0-0 to QPR, you've got to be worried. But apparently they played well today. And that's our, you know, Let's have a bit of applause for Joe Bellingham. He's 18 years old. He's been a virtual ever-present. He scored seven goals from midfield. Another one today. He scored the second. And of course he's not going to be consistent. Of course he's not going to be the match winner at this stage in the way that his older brother Jude is. But, you know, he's been a terrific signing. I think he's now the club's second top scorer. They've got two winnable home games coming up against Blackburn and Bristol City. And, of course, Patrick Roberts should be back soon. And Jack Clark's not too far away. So, all of a sudden, Mackham's, life's not too bad, is it?
No, it's not. And you might have heard on the Three Legends just before you started, all the lads went for Sunderland to win two successive games. That's how they're looking at it.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, that's what away wins do. You know, it boosts the confidence, and confidence can't have been that high. I know Mike Dodds was saying it wasn't on the floor, but, you know, it does change things, and Cardiff were in form themselves. 2-0 win is a terrific result. Now, I know one person who will be a very happy man right now is my first guest. It's the longest-serving football photographer in the Northeast, Ian Horrocks, who used to work for the Evening Chronicle. He was a freelance. Then he worked for Newcastle United. Now he works at Sunderland. Now, I spoke to him yesterday before he flew off with the team down to South Wales, and I'm sure he'll be in midair with a happy Sunderland squad right now. But anyway, I caught up with him yesterday to talk, not so much about the games that have already taken place, but his life as a football photographer in the region. I think the big difference between a journalist and a photographer, I think your pictures, they're etched in the memory of many fans, while reports tend to be read and then forgotten about. You've taken some pretty iconic snaps in your time, haven't you?
Possibly, yeah. It seems like a long time since I first started on the Gated Post, but yeah, travelled a bit and seen some things, done some things, yeah. Very varied.
And, I mean, it's stated the obvious, I guess, but the big difference between a writer and a photographer, you have got to be there at the moment, at that time in history. Reporters can get stories over the phone. Obviously, you've got to be at a match to report it, but, you know, a lot of my time is sitting at a desk. You've got to be there. So you've been all over the place, really, haven't you?
Yeah, well, we always have a laugh, photographers, when we hear reporters complaining about the wet in the press box.
Well, I know. I mean, we see in press rooms, and we've got about 5 layers on. You've got about 25 layers on.
Yeah, well,
and that's just
it's a job which is strange. In the winter, it's really difficult, and in the summer, it's quite nice if you get the good weather. So,
Now you were at the Gates at Post. You moved to the Chronicle, then you worked for Newcastle United. You're now working for Sunderland, and there must be certain photographs, certain occasions which stand out for you. Of course, you were the main man when Alan Shearer signed for Newcastle, when thousands of fans sat. That's a day that stands out in your memory, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I was lucky enough that day to be the only one who was allowed onto the podium where Alan stood up in front of all those fans that had gathered in the car park at the back of the Leasers End at St. James's. Luckily, when I asked him to spin round and hold out his hands open, he did it. And that was the picture that it got wraparounds on all the national newspapers the next day. And, you know, at the time, it was a record transfer fee for any...
It was a world record fee, indeed. That must give you a kick when your picture is seen
by
millions of people around the world, really.
Yeah, of course, you know, you're very lucky to be in that privileged position. But, it's a strange route from the Chronicle to the football club. I was asked by Freddie Fletcher to come for an interview initially, and then Sir John Hall interviewed me. And I was lucky enough to get that position, you know. So it led to a great deal of experience, a great deal of travel for me. And as you say, I was lucky enough to be the one on the spot at that time to get that picture and the only one to get it, you know. So, yeah.
And of course, a few days after Alan Shearer signed, did you fly out to the Far East on tour?
Yeah, we went... I was got a phone call from Sir John Hall, told me to fly to Heathrow. And when I was at Heathrow, I didn't really know that much about it. I met Russell Cushing, who was the then secretary of the football club, and Alan Shearer. And I can remember travelling along in a golf cart somewhere in the back passages of Heathrow to catch a flight out to Singapore. And just all these press and TV cameras chasing us, and I was sitting next to Alan Shearer. It was quite a surreal sort of thing for a young lad from County Durham to do, you know. But it was a great experience. Great experience.
I don't. It's strange, isn't it? Because you know we've worked in the same fields for. Well, coming on to 4 decades now, and yet there's lots about a snapper's job, which I don't know about, just as there's probably lots about a hack's job you don't know about. But tell me, do you still get the biggest kick out of sitting behind the goal watching a football match?
Yeah, because it's, you can't predict what's going to happen. So, some matches are terribly boring, Ian. You know, you've watched them and it's watching paint dry sometimes. But others are really exciting, things happening every 5 or 10 minutes, and your job is to stay focused, stay on it, and get that. Nowadays, it's a lot easier than it used to be, mate, because technology helps us a lot more now.
Of course, but, it will do, yeah.
I mean, when I first started, we had to run films back from the football grounds, both Roker Park and St. James's Park. And
I can
only stay for the first 10 minutes and then take the films back.
I can remember when at both grounds for the football pink and the football.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
You'd see a photographer leaving at 3:15 so to get the picture on the front page and then to set the pages of the pinks. Yeah.
Well, I've had quite a few speeding fines coming back through East Bolton on the way back from Roker Park. Because obviously it was a longer travel back to Newcastle Chronicle, which that's where we put everything together. So you run down from St. James's Park, but you'd have to fly back from Roker Park.
Right.
And now you can send images within seconds of taking them. So there's a massive difference in technology from when I first started to now.
And what are the pictures that you want to capture more than any other? Is it the celebration pictures? Is it the moment the ball hits the back of a net? Is it an aerial duel?
Well, it's goals and celebrations.
Yeah.
But I mean, not every match has that, obviously. So you'll start off a game and what we generally do now is we'll get our manager's pictures first. You'll see the photographers congregated around the dugout before the match actually kicks off. So we'll get that first and get some close-ups, some like feature-type pictures of both managers. You'll send them first. Then you'll try and get some decent action within the first 10 minutes so that the people you're supplying, in my case now, that would be the Sunderland media team. So you give them some imagery to work with. And then hopefully you catch, the goal mouth incidents, a goal, and you hope that the celebration comes towards you. So, that's basically what you're looking for.
Yeah, I remember I used to cover Wimbledon for many, many years, and talking to a photographer down there, and he said that he used to love photographing Roger Federer. He said he was the most photogenic individual he'd ever done because every single shot was perfect, you know, there wasn't a hair out of place. Even his left hand, which the fingers on it were artistically placed, as it were. Are there some players who are more photogenic than others?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you also get to know, if you follow a team like I'm doing at the minute closely, you can kind of anticipate what they're going to do and their movement and who they may pass to. And, you know, there's definitely some which are stronger image-wise. I can remember probably I've never taken a bad picture of Les Ferdinand, for example. He's such a strong person. And he just bossed it on the field a lot, you know. So he was always sort of shouldering people out of the way and you always seem to get good pictures of him, you know. So people like him, I mean, at the minute, Jack Clark scoring all the goals for Sunderland at the minute. And he's a dream because his celebration is extended. He keeps it going and going.
Yeah,
and then he'll turn to his teammates, but he still turns back to the photographers. And it's great for us, you know, because we know we're going to get something else, you know. So it gives us plenty of stuff. We love that, you know what I mean, if we've got lots to choose from.
So at kickoff time, would your default position, your lens focused on somebody like a Jack Clark, who is more likely to score a goal than, for argument's sake, a centre half or a fullback?
Yeah. Well, you'd follow the game, Ian. If a winger, for example, is carrying the ball, you'd follow him, see if he actually runs it in the box and has a shot. If you think he's getting to the byline, he's going to put a cross across, then you'd change your focal point to the players in the centre of the box on the penalty spot, for example. And you'll anticipate who's going to get it. You'll be looking at their eyes to see who's anticipating heading the ball or striking the ball. And it doesn't always work. You know, sometimes things happen. You've seen in football, like that the famous one at Sunderland when the bouncy ball came on the pitch. And everybody was confused by that. All the photographers, you know, kind of, it all got confused, that situation. Some people missed the shot.
Darren Bent against Liverpool with 2007. Yeah. I remember.
Yeah. So it's, you know, things can happen. I mean, you've been to football matches like I have, and like the unexpected will sometimes happen. And, you know, somebody will make a great save and you'll have that moment, but then it'll drop to somebody for a tap in and you'll miss it. That's the sort of thing that happens. You just try and anticipate what's going on. And, you know, most of the time you get it, but sometimes you're unlucky as well.
So you mentioned the famous Shearer picture from August 1996. Are there any matches that stand out? I mean, you've got thousands of pictures to choose from, but from your own personal point of view, either because you were pleased with the shot or the special circumstances, can you talk about that?
There's some good memories. I mean, recently, obviously Sunderland coming up into the Championship was a great occasion, and you know, it's the most recent memory. But games like Newcastle Sunderland, when it was when there's a big pile on and Kevin Nolan scored and started the to mimic the Robbie Elliott celebration.
That's right. Yes.
But yeah, different games stick in your memory. When I think when I can remember quite distant past when Vinnie Jones went in goal for Wimbledon. That you know, trying to think of the other ones which are quite memorable as well.
Paolo Di Canio's slide along the touchline of St James's. Did you were you there that day? You would have been, of course.
I was, yeah, I was. But I wasn't photographing for Sunderland that day, so I didn't capture that particular moment because he would have had his back to us then. So it was everybody who was doing Sunderland attack, and he obviously slid towards the Sunderland fans. So that's one I didn't capture. But obviously, all the people at the right end caught that, you know.
I remember back in the day, Ian, you used to see the toss of the coin, and a captain would choose which end to attack in the first half, and then you'd see a massive pile of photographers. You don't see as much now. Why is that?
Well, there's different rules at different grounds. I know at Newcastle, although I haven't visited there for some time, the photographers, they have to pick a spot and they're not allowed to move unless you're the club photographer.
Right,
and that's because, I'm presuming that's because they get so many applications for photographers' spots, and it's a way to make sure it runs smoothly. So basically, if you go there as a representative of PA or Getty, you stay at one end. Mm-hmm. But that's not the case at Sunderland. Sunderland, we allow photographers to change ends. So you do get that to a certain extent, but you know, I think most of them probably they'll just contain themselves at one end and stay there and just wait for it to switch around in the second half. I obviously can't do that, so I've got to run to the other end because I'm principally there, or I'm my main reason for this is to cover.
Yeah, of course,
and celebrations, of course.
That's right. Go on.
Well,
I'm fascinated by all this. I'm learning so much from you, Ian.
Yeah, it's different rules at different grounds, basically. So that's the answer to that.
Now, of course, a photographer's role, it's not just covering matches, it's covering signings, it's doing special features with players. But I'd like to talk to you about the beginning of the season, the team picture. How on earth does one man get, 30 or 40 people to stare into the camera at that precise point? Or is it a case of it takes ages to do that?
Well, the answer is there's a lot of preparation goes into it. And I tell you who are some of the unsung heroes in that preparation. You've got the kit men. So at my time at Newcastle, that would be Ray Thompson. Mm-hmm. And at Sunderland, that would be John Cook and Steve Aziz. And you make sure that you always make sure you consult with the kit men in terms of who's arranged where. Also, the PR heads like at Sunderland, that would have been Louise Wanless before she sadly passed away. I mean, a lovely lady. She would have input into it, and you know, those sort of set of people would make the basic framework. And then at the last minute, the manager may come in and say, all right, I want this person here. And that was down to them, you know what I mean, at the very end. But then you've got to obviously make sure that they're all looking at the camera, they're all facing the right way. And when there's 30-odd people on a picture, you have to take a lot because you need to check that all their eyes are open on the individual frame.
Of course.
There's been a couple of times where we've had to have a stand-in for a player which was either injured or wasn't there. Quite a few times, actually. I can remember Mark Cannon, the press man at Newcastle, standing in once.
I never knew that.
Yeah, he stood in once, and we basically had to put the missing player's head on Mark Hannan's body.
Is that right?
And also at Sunderland, I think Andrew Lisco once, who's now at Newcastle, he once stood in for a player as well. So, and of course, that's happened.
A few years ago, anyone with on crutches or broken legs had to be hidden away at the back, didn't they?
Well, either that or they'd sit at the front with the advertising board in front of them. So the anybody with leg injuries would sit there at the front with the ad boards in front of them. We have had, I can remember one in particular. I hadn't started working for the football club, but I think I was on an agency. And it's when Newcastle United used to invite every photographer in to do their team picture. Now, usually it's just the club photographers. Right. But we'd been in doing the team picture, and I think it was a Scottish player called Darren Jackson.
Oh, I remember.
We realised half the way through that he had his shorts down when we're taking the picture.
Right.
So it was kind of right towards the end of the session, and I said, "Stop! You know, you're going to have to get him to pull his shorts, and we have to do it all again."
Fantastic.
And that was his idea of a joke, you know what I mean? Darren Jackson. Yeah. That's showing me age,
We're going into sort of the second half of the 80s then, aren't we?
And
exactly. Darren Jackson. Yeah. Although of course a lot of your work is doing feature work with players, and I guess you get to form good relationship with players. Are there any particular friendships you've struck up over the years?
I to be honest with you, I try not to be too busy around the players because I think now sometimes they think they look at you and you think, oh God, he's just wanting to get in or he's wanting a bit of the limelight. But yeah, there's been loads of players. You know, Alan Shearer was great. Peter Beardsley was great with me. And he did a load of stuff for us to help raise money for a boxing club I'm connected with. Loads of players, Shea Given, Steve Watson, Lee Clark. I mean, it's Sunderland. Lee Catamall was excellent to work with, a real gentleman. John O'Shea, brilliant, brilliant person. You know, but generally speaking, most of the lads are always good. The only trouble you get, I think, sometimes is with an influx of foreign players more latterly, like they can be isolated a little bit. And it's hard to relate to them and get on with them because it's hard to have a conversation with them, really. But
but the changing face of football.
Yeah, but the local lads, I'd say, at both clubs, and you know, some of this backroom staff as well are absolute brilliant people. Like some Mark Prideaux, he's the goalkeeping, a long-standing goalkeeper coach at Sunderland. He's a fantastic bloke. I mean, he's great crack, always making people laugh and sharing jokes and trying to keep it all upbeat.
I remember reporting on Mark when he was in golf at Darlington when I first came in sports journalism.
He's a really experienced coach, and when you think about the goalkeeper he's helped produce,
Jordan Pickford and him are very close, aren't they?
That's the latest one, yeah. But I mean, you know, he's. He does a great job, and I mean, there's others as well, like Derek Wright at Newcastle. He's a great lad.
Legend.
Shared many experiences on away trips with Derek, and he's local to me as well. He comes from Stanley as well, so we're both up Stanley lads type of thing.
And of course, a lot of your work sometimes for programmes. You will go to players' homes or perhaps photograph them in unusual places.
Yeah.
What's the most unusual place you've been asked to do some work?
Oh, well, we promoted a kit for Sunderland which was connected to coal mining. And I can remember the model was a member of staff who works behind the scenes at Sunderland who was an ex-miner. He worked at the Monk Weymouth Colliery before the Stadium of Light was built.
Right.
And we went up to the drift mine at Beamish with studio lights, went right at the end of the drift mine and had him with a top on at the coalface as it was. So, yeah, that was a pretty unusual one to do. But wow. I remember I went down to the Ritz. Bobby Robson and Lady Elsie asked me, he was at Buckingham Palace to receive a gong of some kind. And he said, can you come down? We're going to have tea at the Ritz. And could you set up a studio and just do some official pictures for the family? So I went down to London, set up in the Ritz, which obviously Bobby had connections with, and just did his pictures for him. So yeah, it can be very wide and varied, you know what I mean? It's an interesting job, yeah.
I hope they gave you a meal there.
Well, they did offer, but I knocked it back in. I felt like I would be encroaching a bit. But obviously, the you know, when you do things like that, they're very kind. And so Bobby was always very kind.
Oh, what a gentleman he was.
Lady Elsie, of course. Lovely, yeah.
I know something else that you've always enjoyed, because you've told me at Christmas time, going with the teams to the hospitals, to the children's wards. You've always got a bit of a kick out of that, haven't you?
Well, you get a kick, but it's tinged with sadness as well, because I've got two boys myself, and I've got a granddaughter now. And, you know, when you see these children who are seriously ill, and it's, you know, you're asking the lads to go and relate to them and talk to them and try and lift them a bit. It's just extremely sad. Now, I'm not saying all the children are like that, but some of the kids that visit are very sick, and it's a difficult thing to try and do, and it's hard to approach, and you don't want to be too pushy and always ask permission from the parents and stuff like that. But most of the time, it's, you know, people grant permission, and it's tinged with a bit of sadness but happiness as well, you know.
Of course. Do you know, Ian, I think I've learned more about sports photography in the last 25 minutes than in the previous 25 years, and I'm sure the listeners they'll now pardon me, they'll now know that it's not just a case of pressing the shutter down and photography, but for one last question I've got to ask you. I was on the road for about 15 years, and I'm not so much now, but my goodness, you've been on the road home and away, Newcastle, and now more lately Sunderland for years now. Do you still enjoy the travel? Do you still enjoy all that?
I'm gripped by football, to be honest with you, Ian. I mean, this afternoon I go and fly down to Cardiff with Sunderland, and you know, I'm lucky to be able to do it in a way which makes life quite easy for me.
Yes.
I have to say the people at Sunderland are fabulous to work with and for, even though I'm still on a freelance basis. And yeah, I mean, I still get a kick out of trying to capture that decisive moment and the celebration and everything that ensues. You know, it's kind of when you're involved directly with football clubs, it's just a buzz, you know. It's something which I'm lucky, very lucky to be able to do as a job, you know.
Yeah, well, I've always said, and I'll always say to youngsters looking for jobs in the media, yeah, yes, you've got to have talent, but you've also got to have passion and enthusiasm, and I think you've got all three qualities in abundance. So thanks much, Ian, and safe trip.
No problem, mate. Good luck.
All the best. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
There you go.
You know, I don't know about you, Dave. We've been in the business a long time, and I've probably been guilty of just taking photographers for granted. You know, you say hello to them in the press room, and you might go for a drink occasion with them, but I didn't know a lot about their jobs. And when you think about it, you know, my reports will be long forgotten. Some of your broadcasts might be long forgotten, but... Yep. Pictures, they stay in the memory bank, don't they? And some of the pictures that Ian's taken over the years are some of the most famous in Northeast football history.
I tripped over one today, not one of Ian's, but one of those photographs, one of those iconic moments, and it was Craig Hignett celebrating at the brand new Riverside when the first goal had been scored, that one against Chelsea. You know, and he's got both fists clenched, he's looking up to the sky and he's running away in celebration. You know, they stay with you. You're dead right. You know, whether I did a Borough commentary, it stays in my mind. I'm sure, you know, the pieces that you're fond of doing stay in your mind, but you're right. It's it's those images that that have captured the moment.
Well, that's right. A journalist shouldn't really say this, but it is true that pictures do paint 1,000 words, don't they?
Yes, yes, absolutely. So, yep.
Listen, isn't it nice that we're not having a post-mortem tonight discussing Sunderland's slide and Middlesbrough stuck in mid-table? Well, yes, they are in mid-table, but there's a little bit of momentum there. You know, I don't think anyone expected the both sides to come back to the region undefeated.
No, absolutely. 4 points out of a possible six. I think it's been a great weekend. Now Newcastle have to follow that up against West Ham tomorrow. The pressure's on for once.
The pressure is on. Your instinct is to think Newcastle will win at home. Now, obviously, we all thought they'd beat Luton, they didn't. We thought they'd beat Bournemouth, they didn't. But then they had a relatively straightforward game against Wolves. Now, West Ham are a similar team to Wolves in that, you know, the mid-table, they've got they're looking at maybe back in the conference or perhaps Europa League, which is what Newcastle's ambitions are as well. Now, Newcastle fans might not like to hear this, but they are two evenly matched sides. Why do I say that? Because the tables say so. They are capable of very, very good performances, but they're also capable of very mediocre performances this season. And will the real Newcastle turn up tomorrow? Well, what is the real Newcastle? We still need to find out, don't we?
We do. And will the real West Ham turn up as well? Because, like you say, you know, they can blow hot as well as cold.
Indeed. And a little sort of sideshow tomorrow is that I would imagine that Mark Bowen and Anthony Gordon, who both impressed for England in midweek, well, certainly Bowen against Belgium and Gordon against Brazil, are they vying for the same slot in Gareth Southgate's Euro squad? So I'm sure that the England coach will be keeping an eye on how those two individuals do tomorrow afternoon.
Indeed, indeed. Well, time for a quick break, then second guest time on Black and White and Red All Over.
My second guest is Louise Taylor, the long-serving writer for The Guardian, The Observer, still the only full-time female football journalist in the Northeast. She was one of the pioneers, really, and she does a fine job for the publication she works for.
Black and white and red all over. 3 decades of reporting North East football. Ian Murta. The Cat, the Tune
and the Red. Hello, Louise Taylor, and welcome back to the Black and White Red All Over show for the second time this season.
Hello, Ian. Thanks very much for inviting me back.
No problem. When I was speaking to the three legends earlier, I described you as the first lady of Northeast football, and I think it's a title you deserve. I think you've covered at least as many matches as I have, and dealt with as many managers, which is rapidly, I think it's between 70 and 80 managers so we've dealt with since breaking into the job in the 80s.
I know, it's pretty scary. I think you're probably slightly ahead of me in the Northeast, but I think we're in a race. So, it reflects, and it probably speaks volumes about why the Northeast hasn't won trophies and hasn't been successful in the wider context.
Well, that's right, and that's a very good point. Well, at least tonight it should have an upbeat tone to it, because it's the first time that the show has been on after two of our sides have played, and I didn't expect Sunderland to win at Cardiff or Middlesbrough to pick up a point at Southampton. I'm sure you didn't either, but you know, great results for the two teams against their tough opponents.
No, they're both excellent results. I mean, I completely agree with you. I think I expected to be sort of talking about disappointment again. I mean, the wider shame is that is it too little too late for the playoffs? I mean, I think Michael Carrick's done a really good job at Middlesbrough, and he's got a weaker squad than last season, but the perverse thing is they always do well against the better sides. I mean, I think we were both together at the Leicester game at the Riverside when they won, which was one of the most enjoyable games and clever games I've seen this season.
Yes, agreed.
Yeah, I mean, it was really, really tactical. And again, Southampton, here they've got a point, albeit at the 11th hour. So, but I fear they're not quite going to make it. And Sunderland, I think it's going to be next season. But
yes, but I think Middlesbrough have an outside chance. If you know, going into Easter on the back of a 5-match unbeaten run isn't to be sniffed at. Now they've left themselves an awful lot of work to do, and I would give them maybe a 1 in 5 chance of making the top six. Sunderland, well, sadly, in hindsight, their chance went the day they got rid of the manager who I felt could have led them into the playoffs, Tony Mowbray. But, you know, there's seven matches played before today, 1 point out of a possible 20 on. It was relegation form, and I was worried for them. But they stopped the rot last week and they picked up a good win. There should be a decent crowd at the stadium allowed for a winnable game against Blackburn on Monday. And encouragingly, the two most dangerous players, Jack Clark and Patrick Robert, are on the verge of a return.
Yes, I mean, that's really encouraging for a strong end to the season. And often teams that end the season on a good note start the next season well. I mean, albeit with Sunderland, it's going to be a changing of the guard and new management. I mean, I would completely endorse that sacking Tony Mowbray was a dreadful decision. And I'm sure the board are reflecting on that. And knowing that they, you know, they've made a terrible mistake and they need to get things right next time. I think with Middlesbrough, it'd be fascinating if they did get into the playoffs with that 1 in 5 chance, which is probably about right. Because, I mean, last season, they obviously, it was very flat against Coventry in the semi-final and they disappointed, they underachieved. But they've got this track record of beating all the top teams and doing well in the Championship. They've been the great disruptors in a sense. I mean, they sort of destabilised Leicester by doing the double over them. So could they sneak into the playoffs and then cause the biggest shock?
Well, you know, I think that's a very good point. As things stand, Leicester have lost the place in the automatics. And a few weeks ago, I always thought if Sunderland or Middlesbrough did sneak into the top six, then they had no chance of winning promotion, really, because of the sides who they'd be competing against were so strong. But let's take the league table as it is now. Ipswich and Leeds in the promoted places. Leicester, if they don't go up automatically after looking cert for most of the season, they'll be on a real downer. Southampton, you know, they were flying a few weeks ago. They're not so much now. Norwich, well, I would say they are beatable. West Brom are out of the sides currently in the top, holding down position 3-6, are the ones who look, at this stage, best equipped and in the form to go all the way.
No, I think you're right, but Middlesbrough can beat them. I mean, there is if they could just, it's like an eye of the needle gap. But if they could get through it, and they've missed out in the playoffs when we thought they would do much better. So anything's possible. But being in the Northeast, we're probably resigned to disappointment. So we shall see. But. I hope Michael Carrick remains in the job next season, because I think he's done a really good job there, and I think he could ultimately get it right at the Riverside.
I do. I think he enjoys it. In a strange sort of way, the fact Middlesbrough haven't been pushing for automatic promotion probably increases the chance of him staying at the Riverside. But yes, certainly I think that the platform is there for a push, as it is at Sunderland, because, you know, we've talked a lot about the promising youngsters at Sunderland. But you look at right now, Middlesbrough 10th place, Sunderland 12th. Let's shoot up to the Premier League. Right now, Newcastle United are 10th. If they don't win tomorrow, if they lose against West Ham, they could slip into 12th place in the table, which is something I don't think anyone envisaged back in the autumn when they were beating Paris Saint-Germain. On the face of it, Louise, this is a clash between two mid-table sides with little to choose between them. Is that a fair comment?
I think so, definitely. And I mean, I think it's quite interesting that Eddie Howe was strongly praising David Moyes, as managers tend to do in pre-match press conferences today. But I mean, I think we both remember when David Moyes was at Sunderland and he had perhaps one of his most underwhelming seasons in his career, and Sunderland went down. I mean, not entirely David Moyes' fault. It had been coming for a while. But I think a lot of Northeast reporters have a certain scepticism about David Moyes and his capabilities. But if you look at his wider record, it does stand up to scrutiny.
Can I just go off at a tangent there? I don't know if you can remember. Can you remember what he did at the press conference on the Good Friday before Easter Sunday during his one season on Wearside?
I can't remember that specific press conference, but if you jog my memory a bit further, I probably will.
Well, he handed out Easter eggs to all the press. I don't know. It was bizarre.
Oh, I wasn't there. I would have remembered it. I must have been somewhere else because I would definitely have remembered that one.
Yeah, I think I scoffed yours, Louise. But it was bizarre. Of all the managers that we've dealt with. And he sat down and the press officer came with this big box and there was David Moyes handing out Easter eggs, not just little Cadbury's cream eggs, but full-blown Easter eggs to us all. And it was very strange. But there you go. His time in the Northeast is not fondly remembered, either by ourselves, the fans, or even him. I think he tends to leave his his time in Sunderland off his CV, doesn't he?
Yes, absolutely. Well, gosh, the only time that I've had had chocolate handed out by a football club was when I went to Wolfsburg versus Manchester United for a Champions League tie. I was standing in for a Manchester United reporter, and it was shortly before Christmas, and they gave us beautiful sort of packages of chocolate Santa Clauses and stuff. So,
fantastic.
So David Moyes has just gone up slightly, in my opinion. Eddie Howe, take the hint.
Now, Newcastle against West Ham. I was saying earlier, they won their last home game, which seems a long, long time ago, against Wolves, which was their first win at St. James's Park since before Christmas. Wolves and West Ham, as well as beginning with Ws, they're very similar sides, aren't they, in that, they've probably got their sights set on the same type of finish as Newcastle have right now. Gary O'Neill at Wolves, he claimed rather bizarrely that Wolves deserved something from the game at earlier this month. But this is a game Newcastle fans will feel relatively confident of winning, but it's no gimme.
No, absolutely not. I mean, yeah, that was quite fascinating when Gary O'Neill claimed, because I mean, to most sort of regular Newcastle watchers, including me, I thought that Eddie Howe had quite sensibly instructed the team to stand off, you know, not do this aggressive high press and counterattack Wolves. But Gary O'Neill claimed that it was that his tactics meant that Newcastle couldn't get the ball and they wanted to have the ball. So, I mean, he said, oh, Eddie Howe wouldn't do that. So it was a bizarre, although low-key, managerial spat. I mean, I think Gary O'Neill was being a bit disingenuous. But yes, there are certain similarities. And it's going to be very curious whether Eddie Howe persists with the back three that he played at Manchester City in the FA Cup quarter-final, or goes back to his generally preferred back four. I mean, today...
I was not at the press conference. Did he give any hints?
Yes, well, I asked him about it, and he said that it was under consideration, the back three. Now, with Eddie Howe, you've got to sort of hunt for subtext, and you can't take anything at face value. But I mean, I wouldn't rule it out entirely. I mean, obviously, Sven Botman is out of the equation now. And I mean, Fabian Scher might be excellent as a sweeper, you know, with his ball skills. I mean, I think it could suit their setup, particularly if Kieran Trippier and Tino Livramento aren't fit. I mean, Lewis Hall, when he came on, did relatively well at City, and Eddie Howe praised him in the press conference today, which is probably a first. So it might be a new chance, a way of showcasing a different system, showing he can be flexible, particularly with Lewis Miley as well out in central midfield. Yes. The midfield options are diminishing, so that wing-back system could camouflage some problems.
So who would play as the third centre-half, Louise, alongside Scher and Lascelles?
Dan Byrne. I think of course, anyhow, Dan Byrne.
Of course, Dan Byrne. It's a silly question, really, but you forget Dan Byrne is a centre-half. He's played so much of his Toon career as a left-back, of course.
I mean, that's his natural position. I mean, yes. I'd love to see Paul Dummett having another chance, but I think he would play Dan Byrne, then maybe Lewis Hall, or if he's fit, Livramento, and if Kieran Trippier is fit, play him on the right. I mean, obviously Jacob Murphy played there when Trippier was injured at City, so there are options.
Paul Dummett has played some terrific games as a centre half, and you know he's. I think he can count on one hand the amount of games he's started under Eddie Howe, but he's a player I admire, and he's a player I think Newcastle fans are very fond of. But what about the midfield? I mean, will Longstaff retain his place? Because he's come, like Dan Byrne, of course, he's come in for some criticism for his recent performances, hasn't he?
And I think he's struggled with injury, and he's been playing with painkilling injections. I mean, Eddie Howe seemed to suggest today that after the Dubai break, which they went away in the international break, that Sean Longstaff was slightly better now and ready to play again and play at his best. I suspect he'll start him. He probably needs a rest. Elliot Anderson is also coming back from a long-term back injury.
Of course,
I mean, he's
yes.
very talented, but we haven't really seen enough of him. I mean, I suspect he'll start Sean Longstaff, Bruno Guimaraes, and Joe Willock as the midfield three, and maybe play, if he plays the back three, Alexander Isak and Anthony Gordon up front. But who knows? I mean, with Anderson on the bench, I mean, I think that one of the caveats about Eddie Howe is that perhaps when players have had injuries like Sean Longstaff and he's needed to pull them out, he hasn't. I mean, like with Lewis Miley, I think he knew that at 17 he shouldn't be playing this many games, and to me it was certainly no surprise that he's suffered this back injury with the under-20s and being sent back. And I think they now know that they have to rest him. They can't really play him again this season. And again, you've got the Botman issue. I mean, this morning in the press conference, he was saying that Sven Botman didn't want ACL surgery in September. He resisted it, and you can't make any player have an operation. But you still wonder about that.
That's right. It's a strange one. In all my years covering football, I can't recall a man just saying something like that, saying that a player has decided against having an operation for a serious injury, has decided that rest and carrying on playing is the answer. Can you recall anything similar to this one?
No, I absolutely can't. And I mean, it was a very fascinating interview that Botman gave when he came back, I think in December, to Sky. I mean, he said that, yes, it was an ACL. I mean, Eddie Howe had never specified the injury. He said it was an ACL, and a few of the surgeons he'd been to see, several knee specialists, had said that it was a complete rupture. But there was also a suggestion it might be a partial rupture, and there is the option of self-healing, which I think Dean Whitehead years ago at Sunderland underwent that successfully, and maybe Sean Longstaff as well, although it took him a long time to get back properly. and that he'd followed that option. But generally, I mean, having had a couple of knee surgeries myself, I mean, hardly being an athlete, but the surgeon definitely guides you. You know, they can be pretty pretty frank and specific about, as you know yourself, but, you know, they're pretty specific about what will happen if you don't have the surgery and the realities of the situation.
That's right.
And also, I think most managers, I mean, nobody wants to have an operation unnecessarily, absolutely not. But most football managers, you know, if they're properly briefed, would basically tell the player, well, yes, you've got to have this. And I mean, had Sven Botman had the operation in September, he would be well on the way to recovery now. And,
indeed.
And fingers crossed, fine for next season. But now it's looking next January.
That's right. Let's turn to two individuals who will be on the pitch tomorrow lunchtime, Louise. If you were the England manager and you'd pick 22 of your players, let's assume that the Euros will be 23-man squads, and you had to choose between Mark Bowen and Anthony Gordon for the final place, who'd get it?
Anthony
Gordon.
Or will
you be able to answer? You say that now. I mean, are they fighting for the same place? Because although they're not identical players, you can't really see room for both of them in the three Lions squad this summer, can you?
No, I mean, I completely agree. They are different players, and I think if it is increased to a 26-man squad, which Gareth Southgate is clearly lobbying for, that they could both be on the plane. But I think Anthony Gordon, as he's made that late run, you know, he's kind of kicked for the finishing line, and I mean, his attitude is tremendous, and that will probably have impressed Gareth. And I think he's done very well, and he played really well against Brazil, and that's probably the reason that has got him, you know, certainly one foot on the steps to the plane.
I just wonder if Gareth will be at St James's Park tomorrow, running the rule over the two of them.
I think he could well be. I mean, I would be actually quite surprised if he's not there. I think he'll be quite fascinated, because it could be, you know, it could be a watershed moment, you know, to see how they do. I mean, I think Anthony Gordon's collective body of work over the season has been really impressive.
I would agree.
Roles,
I mean,
across the
if you're voting Newcastle's Player of the Year, I think he would be a pretty much a unanimous choice, although Shares had a very good season as well. Guimaraes has probably been up and down, but has had some outstanding games. Isak, of course, but he's had injuries. I would think Gordon would be the choice of 80% of the fans right now.
I think you're right. And I think Cher, I'm a big fan of Cher. And I think he's probably, without him, Newcastle might have struggled even more. But I think Gordon will win it. And I think I would, you just have an instinct that the momentum is with him, and that he's the man to go for. And it's quite an interesting trajectory, because, I mean, when he came in January last year, he initially struggled, and he admitted afterwards that he'd taken time to adapt and fathom out Eddie Howe's tactics. But then he went away with the under-21s in the summer. Obviously, they won the tournament. They did so well. And since then, he's never really looked back. And he's kept fighting.
That's right.
Yeah. And he's kept fighting in adverse circumstances. I think Gareth will go for him, you know, barring a total calamity or typical Newcastle injury towards the end of the season.
Indeed. Now, we've only got a couple of minutes left, Louise, and it's prediction time. Now, I'm going to be very rude here and go ahead of you now. I'm going to predict a 2-0 Sunderland win at Cardiff and a late Middlesbrough equaliser at Southampton. So I'm sure I'm going to get those ones right. As for Newcastle, I think it's going to be a hard game, and I'm going to go... I don't think Newcastle will get 6 points out of six in the two home games coming up, but I've got a feeling they will beat West Ham and draw against Everton. I'm going for a 2-1 win to Newcastle tomorrow. What about yourself?
Well, I'm going to kind of reverse those situations. I'm going to say it's going to be 2-2 tomorrow, right, and they're going to win 3-2 on Tuesday against Everton.
Right, interesting. And in the final minute, where will Newcastle finish this season? Will they miss out on Europe completely? Will they get into the Europa League? I think we can rule out the Champions League. Or will they possibly get into the Conference League?
It's a strange one. I think the most likely scenario is that they get into the Conference League, which is the league that no one wants to be in. Whereas I think, I mean, the owners in Saudi clearly want them to be in Europe, but they'd rather it was the Europa. So the Conference is a very strange one. I mean, maybe in that scenario, prefer to be 9th or 10th. I mean, very odd.
Although I'm sure that the Toon Army will enjoy trips to Armenia and maybe Luxembourg and whatever.
Oh, it'd be brilliant.
I think, Europe's fantastic, whatever. So yeah. let's hope yeah. that their chances are increased tomorrow.
Absolutely. Well, I think we would love the Conference League. Whether Eddie Howe does is another question. But I think let's think about the fans.
That's great.
So great.
I've got to cut you off there. We've got the news coming up, but it's been a pleasure once again. And we'll have you on again, if not this season, next season, Louise.
Thanks very much, Ian. Thanks. Good night. The Toon Blackhead and the Red.